It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Well, and we're working towards something, but we didn't sign anything today. It didn't quite work out. I would say that I wasn't satisfied, and perhaps he wasn't satisfied. Good relationship, but I decided that this wasn't the right time to sign something. So we'll see what happens over a period of time.
Sandy Rios with you. That was the President of the United States in the wee hours of the morning talking from Vietnam. The talks with Kim Jong-un have been broken off because they could not agree to anything. It was interesting because Kim Jong-un, in a conversation and in an answer to press yesterday, when asked about doing away with his nuclear capability, said yes, of course he was willing to do that or he wouldn't have come to the summit. So that was very interesting. And the talks seem to have broken down because the Americans at the table revealed that we had a lot more intelligence on what exactly North Korea has in terms of their nuclear capability. And it caught Kim Jong-un by surprise. And the president, of course, was demanding that all of that be dismantled, and they weren't prepared, it sounds like, to make that commitment. And so the president walked away, and that's where it stands. Meanwhile, across the ocean here in Washington, D.C., you may not know, but you need to know that there was a time not that long ago when presidents made overseas trips to represent this country because they are the president of the United States. No one back home criticized the president. They certainly did not hold hearings where people were hammering him as though he were a common criminal, or the allegations made in that hearing yesterday with Michael Cohen. We'll talk about that later, but I just want you to know that that's completely out of bounds. We used to never, out of respect for our president, we united behind him while he was overseas representing us, but the Democrats yesterday broke protocol as they completely, they have no respect for the system or for the president, and they demonstrated it yet once again yesterday. I'm coming to you live from National Harbor, Maryland at the beautiful Gaylord Hotel. This is the place where the 2019 CPAC, Conservative Political Action Committee, is meeting. And there's some, you know, there's a couple of thousand of people here. And the theme this year is What Makes America Great. I'm on Radio Row, which I always enjoy. And sitting across from me is Dan Schneider. Dan is the executive director of the American Conservative Union, which is the parent company which organizes CPAC every year. People know CPAC better than they know ACU, don't they, Dan?
Yeah, well, the brand name is better for CPAC, but that's the name of our annual conference. And we're probably expecting over 10,000 people here.
Sorry. I said two, didn't I? Oh, you know, I'm sorry.
And then
10.
We've got two or ten, whatever. And we've got three satellite locations around the country.
Seriously?
Yeah, so Southern California, Colorado, and Southern Virginia. So we'll have another 10,000-12,000 people watching CPAC live from those stages, too.
You know, I find a lot of people know, they know the name CPAC, but they don't really know what it is. I've had people ask me all kinds of questions and to try to explain it. So you're the boss here. You explain it.
Well, look, it's simple. The American Conservative Union was founded in 1964. After Barry Goldwater lost the presidential race. And it was founded for the purpose of trying to elect a conservative to the presidency and to try to make the conservative voice better heard and to try to take our country back. And our founders, Bill Buckley Jr., Stan Evans, Frank Meyer, Catherine St. George, they knew who they wanted to be president. That was Ronald Reagan. So really, ACU was founded to try to get Ronald Reagan elected president by educating the American public about conservative ideas. CPAC was founded a couple years after that, again, to highlight Ronald Reagan.
You know, the American Conservative Union also, known in certainly in D.C. circles, you guys have like the gold standard for the scorecard.
That's right.
For congressmen.
Every
and you
member
score,
of
like,
Congress.
8,000.
Plus every single state legislator in the whole country. So 8,000 in all.
Yeah. So that means scorecard. You and I know what that means. But
yeah.
What that means that you check what they're voting on you score it.
Right.
And people can sort of look at your score and tell how their particular congressman rates in terms of various
issues. How liberal, how conservative, across the full spectrum of issues. We are a full spectrum conservative organization. So, Jim Jordan, Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, 11 years in a row, 100%. First time in our history that a member of Congress has started off with a perfect scorecard over the course of 11 years. But then we've got people as low as zero, of course.
Name the zero. I want to hear this.
Kamala Harris.
I could put some numbers in there.
Yeah,
I'm just
Senator
kidding.
Kamala Harris. Yeah.
So you score the Democrats, too.
Oh, of course. Every single member of Congress, every legislator in the entire country, 8,000 in all. And, some of course, it's the full spectrum. So we'll get people in the 50s, 60s, 70s, the 30s, the 20s. But we invite the best to come to CPAC.
Yeah, yes, you do. And so 10,000 people here. Yeah. It's just amazing at the Gaylord Hotel. I honestly never dreamed that. It's a big place, but I didn't know it held that many people. In past years, Dan, it's kind of been interesting because I've been, I don't know how long you've been doing Radio Row, but I think I've been here every year.
Yeah.
Actually, however many years that is.
We are always happy to have you here.
A year of it. See, supposed to say that. Here's the 10. the 10,000. but generally speaking, we see so many young people, and that's been happening for years. And there have been factions of them that have broken out. There's a libertarian movement during Rand Paul's years of running, and sometimes they're a handful, as it were, and maybe in a good way, but still a faction to be reckoned with. What do you see now in this 2019 CPAC, the young people coming here? I kind of see a different flavor. I wonder if you do and what you'd say about that.
I think that these college students on these campuses, and these campuses have never been more radicalized. I think that the conservatives on these campuses are so accustomed to fighting back that they've got a kind of excitement and energy and confidence that they can win even when they're being persecuted by the faculty, by the administration, and their fellow students on the campuses.
I agree with you, and I see a maturity beyond their years. I see that this is not scientific, but it surely seems to me that the young people coming around now are a little bit more steeped and in many ways may know more about their elders in terms of the issues down to various layers because they're used to having to make the case, as you said. So it's an impressive group.
Sandy, I'm 52. So, back in the 70s and 80s when I was really starting to follow politics, it was really hard to learn anything. I would get my subscription to National Review, and that's kind of where I could learn stuff, but there was no internet. I would read Bill Buckley writing about Cato. Like, what's Cato? And there was no, I couldn't Google Cato. I went down, I was like,
there was no Google.
I was a teenager.
We have to explain that, that there was no Google.
But now we can learn things so much better, and I think, I do think our young people are better informed.
Yeah, I do too. I think they're adding energy to the movement, and when it comes to socialism, all those issues, they're taking the lead, and I think that's really amazing. Let me just on a personal note, you used to be chief of staff for Jim Ryan, who was the world record holder in the mile.
Yeah.
Jim Ryan,
and
very
the
famous.
Half mile, and the 1500 meters. He owned tons of world records. Yeah.
So Kansas is your home. That's your roots.
Yeah.
And then I also noticed that you majored in economics and Chinese.
Yes.
That caught my eye.
Well, I'm old enough. I was living in China in 1988 and 89. So, we're really focusing on China. This CPAC, we focused on China last CPAC, the threat of China. Mm-hmm. I was in Beijing as the tanks were rolling into the city to Tiananmen Square to begin the massacre. I was literally on the last plane out of Beijing. So we know what the Communist Chinese Party is capable of. We know what they do. They are the single greatest threat to world peace and security that we have today.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. I wasn't there then, but I've been several times to China. It's an amazing country, and the thing that's been a mystery for me and kind of hard to morph into is understanding why they would want to militarily conquer any world. They have such a big country. They've been so isolated, and it's interesting to me that they are, they got this plan. That's been exposed by Bill Gertz years ago about how to overcome our military, and they're doing it.
Copying
our resources, our sophisticated weaponry. They're copying it.
Stealing the technology. Yeah.
Gordon Chang is going to join me Friday, and we will talk more about China. Let me ask you about this CPAC. It's what makes America great. We can only guess why you chose that theme.
You know, lots of people are assuming it sounds similar to Donald Trump's theme, Make America Great Again, but it goes far, far deeper than that. For years, we've heard the liberals essentially saying America is not an exceptional nation. It's not a great nation. And then conservatives say, no, it is. If we're going to have this debate, we need to know what the yardstick, the measuring stick, actually is. How do we determine what is great? What is exceptional? So this CPAC is here to help answer that question.
You know, Rasmussen just did a poll, and the question was, is America responsible, or America is responsible for most of the world's problems? And even military, by huge majority, said yes. Young people certainly said yes, and even a lot of Republicans. It was shocking. You know, I think back on that book that Dinesh D'Souza wrote a number of years ago, What's So Great About America? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
It was a great book. And one of the things that I remember him talking about was, it wasn't, yes, we had slavery, but the thing that makes us great is we got rid of it. We got rid of slavery, and that's one of the points that he made. But what kind of points are you guys going to make here, and who's going to make them? What kinds of things?
Well, when it comes to, we're going to have a set of speeches right at the very beginning, four different people defining what makes America great. So we're going to have Senator Mike Lee talking about our nation's founding. Our nation was founded uniquely in a special time, a special place by special people. We then have Deneen Borelli, who's going to talk about our free enterprise system and how it is the best thing to alleviate poverty ever seen in the world. Marjorie Dannenfeltzer of the Susan B. Anthony list. She's going to be talking about how we respect the dignity of the person uniquely, better than anybody else. And then Colonel Oliver North, will talk about how our military is a force for good. We're the only superpower in world history that has not been a colonial power because we use our military for good. And then all of these speeches are being emceed by Governor Walker of Wisconsin. So he'll then come back on the stage after all these people have explained what makes America great to really synthesize it. But let me just add this. We've got a number of panels and speeches on the family and on faith. One of the things I'm really excited about, we are going to have three people on our stage today, not moderated, just three people having a discussion about faith matters. So Senator Langford of Oklahoma, Matt Spaulding of Hillsdale College, and Ali Stuckey of Blaze TV. That's going to be a really interesting discussion. Why faith matters.
I think that will be a great discussion for this crowd because people here are different faith backgrounds. And I do think sometimes it has to be explained. It's funny because I just did a speech on that in a church on Sunday night, so that resonates with me. I mean, we have to say it again. You know, we don't automatically carry down from generation to generation things that you and I take for granted. We have to re-explain to future generations, and so that's a great idea. Dan, it's been fun talking to you, and thank you for letting me be part of Radio Row.
Oh,
and we look
you.
Forward to seeing what's going to develop here at CPAC. As we hang out.
We're always happy to have you.
Yeah, well, it's great. Glad to be here. So you take care. All right, well, listen, it's great being here. We're going to be having lots of interesting guests this week. We're going to have, on Friday, we're going to have Gordon Chang. We're also going to talk to Matt Schlapp, who is the chairman of CPAC. We're looking for Tom Fitton. Also, Tony Schaefer, who's a national security expert. Many other people. Chris Kobach is coming up today, who used to be the Secretary of State for Kansas. Chris is going to be talking to us about what's happened with voter integrity in the country, and I think that you'll find that fascinating. We're also going to be talking about what's happening to police. You know that numbers of our police are being slaughtered in the streets, and it's having its effect on the police force, on the morale, on recruitment, and actually we're going to talk about that next. So don't go away. Sandy Rios coming to you live from National Harbor, Maryland, back right after this.
A call to action from American Family Radio. not a difficulty in the world. But as the Word of God says, if your brother's in need and you have it within your ability to respond to their need, how can you claim to have love if you allow them to go without? What greater need is there than the need to live? I know life is rough, but it don't have nothing to do with the baby. Don't kill the baby. Don't wait for preborn campaigns. Don't wait for legislation to be passed in your state legislature. Don't wait till Roe versus Wade is overturned. Respond now. I believe with everything in me that we can end this scourge regardless of what they do in the halls of Congress and the halls of the state legislature. Every single family, every single church, go to the local abortion clinics. Let them know that you have people in your churches, people in your family that are willing to take the babies home. They have families that have been dying to take a child home. Don't kill the babies.
Visit AFR.net.
Here's Dan Celia with today's Stewardship Moment.
Proverbs 22 verse 5 says this, "In the paths of the wicked lies thorns and snares, but he who guards his soul stays far from them." We certainly need to guard our soul from becoming wicked and relying on our resources to maintain a reverence for the Lord so that we might guard ourselves from the wickedness that is out there. There must be a level of humility and fear of the Lord in order for us to be successful stewards and in order for us to grow closer for the kingdom of Jesus Christ.
You've just heard a Stewardship Moment with Dan Celia of Financial Issues Ministry, helping you plan, give, and invest wisely. For more information, log on to financialissues.org. That's financialissues.org.
This is Pause to Pray, a moment each day to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for Bill Shine, White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications. After a long media career in the private sector, Mr. Shine accepted an offer from the Trump administration to oversee communication within the White House. 1 Peter 4:10 reminds us of the importance of using our talents to help one another. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask you to guide Bill Shine in his communications role at the White House. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team. Volume 2 of our daily prayer journal is now available. To receive your copy, go to pausetopray.org.
Fox News Commentary with Todd Starnes.
Hello, Americans. How to tell when a convicted liar is telling another lie. That story next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Paul Kizito. I'm a junior biology major here at Truett McConnell, and I came from Uganda. What I love about TMU is number one is the heart of, you know, of just the school and the love for God, for Christ. You can see it once you step on the campus. Like, you can see it's best, like, the foundation for TMU is Christianity.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
President Trump's former lawyer testified before Congress yesterday. Michael Cohen, not exactly a choir boy, a convicted liar. He's been disbarred, heading to prison. Here's what he had to say about his former client.
He is a racist. He is a con man. And he is a cheat.
But Congressman Mark Meadows of North Carolina was not buying what Mr. Cohen was selling.
I guess what I'm saying is I've talked to the president over 300 times. I've not heard one time a racist comment out of his mouth in private. So how do you reconcile it? Do you have proof of those conversations?
I would ask you to.
Do you have tape recordings of those conversations?
No, sir.
And that was the some problem with Mr. Cohen's testimony. Lots of accusations, but not a shred of evidence. I'm Todd Starnes.
That's your Fox News commentary.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Mr. Chairman, here we go. Here we go. Your first big hearing, your first announced witness, Michael Cohen. I want everyone in this room to think about this. The first announced witness for the 116th Congress is a guy who is going to prison in 2 months for lying to Congress. Mr. Chairman, your chairmanship will always be identified with this hearing. And we all need to understand what this is. This is the Michael Cohen hearing presented by Lanny Davis. That's right. Lanny Davis choreographed the whole darn thing. The Clintons' best friend, loyalist, operative, Lanny Davis put this all together. You know how we know? He told our staff. He told the committee staff. He said the hearing was his idea. He selected this committee. He had to talk Michael Cohen into coming. And most importantly, he had to persuade the chairman to actually have it. He told us it took 2 months to get that job done. But here we are. He talked him into it. This might be the first time someone convicted of lying to Congress has appeared again so quickly in front of Congress. Certainly, it's the first time a convicted perjurer has been brought back to be a star witness in a hearing. And there's a reason this is the first, because no other committee would do it. Think about this. With Mr. Cohen here, this committee, we got lots of lawyers on this committee. This committee is actually encouraging a witness to violate attorney-client privilege. Mr. Chairman, when we legitimize dishonesty, we delegitimize this institution. We're supposed to pursue the truth, but you have stacked the deck against the truth. We're only allowed to ask certain questions. Even with that amendment you just told us about, well, Rush is now on the table. You initially told us we can't ask questions about the special counsel, can't ask questions about the Southern District of New York, can't ask questions about Russia. Nope. Nope. Only subjects we can talk about are ones you think are going to be harmful to the President of the United States. And the answers to those questions are going to come from a guy who can't be trusted.
Right, that was Congressman Jim Jordan, who's on the stage here right now, actually, as I speak at National Harbor, Maryland. He and Congressman Mark Meadows were in the hearing yesterday with Michael Cohen, the object of the hearing. I hope you heard part of that, at least some of it, because it was amazing. As I said before, never before in American history has a Congress decided to attack its president while its president is overseas trying to make some sort of a deal with an enemy with nuclear power, trying to get them to do away with their nuclear weaponry to make our country safe. It's never been done where a president has been criticized like this while he's been trying to negotiate overseas. We all have united behind our president in a show of force, because we are, after all, Americans, but not the Democrats. They're not willing to do that. So that was quite a hearing. The Republicans did not get any of the information about the hearing, the statement prior. They got it first thing yesterday morning before the hearing, and then they found out that CNN actually had the information before the congressman did, the Republican congressman. It was just it's a sham. There's a lot more I could say about that, and we will at some point. But I'm here live on Radio Row, and I want to take advantage of talking to lots of really fine people. And one of them is Jason Johnson. Jason is the president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, and he's sitting before me. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Sandy. Thanks for having me.
I'm guessing you were a policeman.
I was.
Where?
I spent 20 years right here in Prince George's County, Maryland, the bulk of my career. And then for the last couple of years, I was deputy police commissioner in none other than Baltimore, Maryland.
Oh, boy. Baltimore. You have stories then, don't you?
I have a few stories. I don't know if we'll get to them today or not.
You must be sick about what's happened in Baltimore.
Yeah, in Baltimore and really in many other parts of the country, what's happened in policing is incredibly unfortunate and really needs to turn around.
Was there, now, okay, so we should say that your particular organization now addresses the political attacks against policemen. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say that's part of our mission. I'd say probably the main part of our mission is that we provide funding for law enforcement officers who actually have been accused of crimes in connection with their work. So if you think about like the Freddie Gray case, those were police officers. We funded their defense, part of their defense, and we look for similar cases throughout the country.
And the case in Ferguson, hands up, don't shoot, that police, whatever happened to that policeman?
Well, he was actually completely cleared, never charged, either locally or at the federal level. Even the Obama Justice Department investigated it and fully cleared the officer as having acted reasonably given the circumstances.
Yeah, but he was like marched. I mean, he can't even have a normal life. Didn't he have
his
to
career
like,
is
go
over.
Into hiding?
His career
Horrible.
Is over. He can't be a police officer anymore, even though he was cleared. I mean, he was cleared in both the investigations and the pretext, the hands up, don't shoot, turned out to be completely false.
Yes, it did. And so, Jason, was there a particular incident? You know, like you've been a active duty policeman for a long time. Was there a particular incident that was a catalyst for you to have a passion about this? Or when did you start seeing this kind of go off the rails?
Early in my career, actually. There was a police officer in Prince George's County where I spent most of my career, which is a major jurisdiction outside of D.C., a police officer named Stephanie Moore, who was prosecuted federally because of a dog bite. And this was in 2000. She spent 8.5 years in prison away from her young child. And it was so upsetting to me that a police officer doing their job the right way, the way she was trained in the correct manner, could be stripped of her career, stripped of her freedom, and spend time in jail. And even though that was early in my career, and I spent a whole career after that in law enforcement, I always had in my mind that that I wanted to do something about it. I even went to law school while I was a police officer in order really to do just this.
Can you, in a nutshell, tell us how... How is she responsible for a dog bite? Was she a canine
division? She was a canine handler. There were a few undocumented immigrants who had broken into a building. And when they came out, one of them attempted to flee, and she sent her dog after the person. There was a dog bite. Mm. And 5 years later, at the end of the Clinton administration, she was indicted right on the eve of the tolling of the limitation period. And went through two trials. First trial was a hung jury. Second trial, she was convicted and ultimately sentenced to 10 years.
Wow. You know, we have to say for people that don't know around the country that Maryland, of course, is way ahead of many of us, many states, in terms of their progressivism. And so we shouldn't be surprised that police should have run afoul with the political whims earlier. And that was just kind of a forecast, I think, of what my personal opinion. During the Obama administration, when it was really became almost all at war against police departments, when he talked about under Eric Holder, bringing justice and addressing racism, which of course, who doesn't want racism to be addressed? But using that as a guise to go in and start really going after policemen in various jurisdictions. New Orleans was one of them. But I should let you talk. I mean, what did you see? You describe it better than I can.
Well, I think it really started in the first 6 months of the Obama administration in 2009 was the latest volley of anti-police sentiment as it really started to get inflamed across the country. When in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a Cambridge police sergeant responded to a call for a burglary and located Professor Henry Louis Gates,
yes.
A Harvard professor, if you remember
yes.
that scenario.
Of course I do.
And that officer was excoriated, including by the president, before the facts were known. He was, if you remember, President Obama said
yes.
he had acted stupidly.
Yes,
for the police
acted stupidly.
Right, and as it turned out...
Before he even knew the facts.
Didn't know the facts. He knew he was associated with, friends with the professor. So that's really when law enforcement really started to stop and take a look and say, hey, what's going on in this country where people seem to be presuming that they've done something wrong or that they're in the wrong or they're not acting lawfully. And certainly it continued in Ferguson, which
yeah.
was a big one.
Yes, Ferguson. And then the Black Lives Matter sort of came out of Ferguson, as I recall. And then we've got them marching in the streets.
Baltimore, Chicago,
but
Ferguson.
What was their chant about pigs? Pigs in a blanket frying like bacon. That's what they were chanting
yeah.
about police. People forget that. You know, there are a lot of people who defend Black Lives Matter now because they think it's some black civil rights group. But honestly, they were violent and wicked
yeah.
early on about and undermining the authority of the police.
Yeah, absolutely. It's deeply concerning, and I know every law enforcement officer out there trying to do their job every day is paying attention to this sort of thing, and it's causing a ripple effect.
Yes, and let's talk about that, because what's it doing to recruitment, for instance?
Well, recruitment's extraordinarily challenging. I can tell you from having been in Baltimore, it's very, very difficult just to keep up with the attrition. So the Baltimore police, just as one example, is grossly understaffed. And they lose hundreds of officers every year to retirement, disability, and so forth, and they can't keep up with that. So as time progresses, really over the last 20 years, every year the staffing of the police department has gone down consistently, and now there's virtually, it's proven impossible almost to overcome the people who leave the agency because I think young people who are getting out of the military, or getting out of college, looking at a career, law enforcement used to be a pretty attractive career, and now they're looking at all the downsides, and they're just looking in another direction.
You know, I've noticed that I think they've been 9 shootings this year already, police, something like that. That seems low, actually,
yeah.
but and so many of them have been young.
Yeah.
Young families, young men.
Yeah.
And so it's just, it really makes normal Americans sick,
yeah.
Jason.
Well, violence,
honestly.
Yeah, you bring that up as a great point. Is it another side effect of this Ferguson effect, if we can call it that, is violence against police officers. Unanticipated, unexpected, yeah. Sudden violence by people who are watching the news coverage and are jumping to conclusions about every police officer, yeah. And it's dangerous.
Just stoking the flames and really reducing what used to keep the peace was just the general respect for police and law and order. And so, you know, there aren't enough policemen in the world to make everybody mind. It's just not going to work when the social order breaks down, and I know that's what you guys are facing.
Yes.
And so then, of course, there's the morale among police, and then we need to talk about just the ability to actually, and we're from Chicago, my husband and I initially. Well, Chicago police are legendary, but they're legendary for good reason. They've actually, yeah. You know, they've got some black marks on there, but they actually do great policing. They have yeah. done. But now their hands are tied, and so are the Baltimore police hands tied. You know, we've seen videos of policemen, you know, standing stoically while people are screaming inches from their faces. You don't have the same natural protections you used to have. Talk about
yes.
that.
Well, I mean, policing has changed significantly. Pretty much everything a police officer does nowadays is being video and audio recorded. And as you pointed out, under very challenging, trying circumstances where they have people who are actually trying to provoke them into a reaction, knowing that it'll be captured by on camera, and then that can later be turned around against the police officer. So training police officers nowadays is more complicated and more difficult than it's ever been, because in addition to giving them basic skills and self-defense and firearms and what the law is, they really have to be trained almost in mental health to be able to de-escalate situations. And again, it's just extraordinarily challenging for them.
Really, plus their time. I've seen in some of these videos that have been captured, the thing that I notice is so much of their time and energy is taken trying to stand down some obnoxious person who's trying to trap them. And so it naturally flows that the real criminals then, the energies are not going toward that. So what is this doing to crime? If policemen can't really respond or can't grab people and, you know, strong arm them, which they need to be able to do, what does that do to crime?
I think if you look at the numbers in most urban centers in the country, crime is up, violent crime is up. Yeah. There are exceptions to that. New York City is doing a good job keeping crime down. I think part of that is that if you increase the staffing of your police department incredibly, I mean, you know, by significant numbers, and you employ technology just the right way, and you have significant economic development, which, of course, New York City has had, then you can overcome the trend. But many other cities like Baltimore, for one example, but there are many others, crime has increased really since 2014, which is the year that we sort of point to as the beginning of the Ferguson effect.
Before we run out of time, you have written about the effects of marijuana on law enforcement, and of course they told us that if we just legalized marijuana, crime would go down, there wouldn't be a black market. What have you found?
So in each jurisdiction that has legalized and created a legal distribution network, like think Washington State, Colorado, and there are a few others, but we look specifically at Washington State and Colorado, that the black market actually has expanded. And with the black market comes increases in violent crime, because dealers combat each other for turf. So we've seen in Denver, for example, back in 2013, right when they started implementing legalization, they had 36 homicides. And then last year in 2018, they had 68. So similar result in Seattle, the major urban center in Washington State. And it can be explained by the perpetuation of the black market. California is having similar struggles, although they have a different model. But the black market is still alive and well in California. And as it seems, pretty much every state that's legalized has not been able to eradicate the black market.
Jason, just seems to be logical to me that the additional use of marijuana is going to create traffic accidents, where the death will result. I mean, all kinds of things, you know, operating heavy equipment.
Yeah.
Where could people find out more information about that? There's the music playing.
Yeah, it'd be great if everyone check out our website, which is policedefense.org. It explains our organization a little bit more and what we do and the officers we support and have supported in the past.
Okay, we'll do that. Policedefense.org. We'll put that on our Facebook page so people can refer to it. Jason, be safe.
Great.
And God bless you for the work that you do on behalf of our safety, all of us.
Thanks, Andy.
We're grateful. So many of us are grateful. I just can't say it enough. And every time I see an officer, I try to let him know. So thank you for standing in the way for us. All right, Sandy Rios, coming live to you from National Harbor, Maryland. And coming up next, a famous person that you've name you heard, but you might not remember why, Chris Kobach, joins us next. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Journalist Megan Murphy filed a lawsuit against Twitter after she was permanently banned from the platform over tweets opining that women aren't men. Murphy, a self-described feminist, tweeted, "Women aren't men. How are trans women not men? What is the difference between a man and a trans woman?" She was put in Twitter jail, only temporarily at first. Once released, Murphy tweeted, "I'm not allowed to say that men aren't women or ask questions about the notion of transgenderism at all anymore." Twitter finally kicked Murphy off permanently. Social media has become the modern public square, but some facts aren't welcome.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Jeremiah 20 verse 9 says, "His word was in my heart like a burning fire." Hi, this is Alex McFarland, co-host of Exploring the Word. You know, I was in my second year of college as a new believer when God put in my heart an insatiable desire to read His word. And that daily reading of God's word has shaped who I am. And every day on Exploring the Word, Bert Harper and I teach the word so that fire and love for Scripture will be in your heart as well.
Exploring the Word, weekday afternoons at 3 Central on American Family Radio.
Pornography is a deadly trap that will undermine your marriage, threaten your family, and destroy your faith. But you can find freedom. On the next Focus on the Family, a pastor and his wife reveal how God rescued their marriage and healed their lives. That's next time on Focus on the Family with Jim Daly.
Focus on the Family is heard each weekday morning at 5 o'clock Central on American Family Radio.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. The problem with America is not with our economy, it's with our families. In too many communities, too many children are born out of wedlock and headed for a life of instability and poverty. Marriage is the fundamental solution to poverty. Studies have shown that if men and women finish their high school education, get a job, and then get married and have children, they and their children have a single-digit chance of winding up in poverty. Saving sex for marriage and remaining faithful to the marriage covenant will enable children to grow up in stable, happy, and secure two-parent families. One of the reasons I wrote the Boy to Man book is to give practical help to fathers of 12-year-old boys on their glide path to forming families of their own. Order a copy today from afastore.net. That's afastore.net.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Trump has channeled his inner Reagan. Just as the Gipper in 1986 walked away from a disarmament negotiation at Reykjavik rather than accede to Mikhail Gorbachev's unacceptable demands, Mr. Trump today truncated his summit with North Korea's despot, Kim Jong-un. Evidently, Kim thought the president was so anxious to secure some deal that he would end all economic sanctions on North Korea in exchange for considerably less than its denuclearization. Instead, as Mr. Trump put it, sometimes you just have to walk away. President Reagan was sharply criticized for doing just that. Inevitably, his successor will be too. As a witness to the Reykjavik summit, I can attest to the intense pressure to accept whatever accord is on offer. It takes guts and a highly commendable determination to put America first, to refuse to go along for temporary political advantage. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Just because someone has a person of color, a black person working for them, does not mean they aren't racist. And it is insensitive that some would even say, the fact that someone would actually use a prop, a black woman, in this chamber, in this committee, is alone racist in itself. Donald Trump is setting
Mr. a precedent. Chairman, I ask that her words Donald be Trump taken down.
It's racist to suggest that I ask her to come in here for that reason.
No, Mr. Chairman, I do not call Mr. Meadows a racist. No, I am trying, as a person of color, Mr. Chairman, just to express myself and how I felt at that moment.
All right, that's just a little bit of an exchange between Mark Meadows and Elijah Cummings and Congressman Rashida Tlaib, the new Muslim representative in the House who's made quite a splash with her a vulgar mouth. And, of course, she did accuse Congressman Meadows of being a racist. That was a truncated clip. And then she walked it back because Elijah Cummings kind of insisted that she do that. But it was really quite a moment. More of the circus that is our Congress right now. Sandy Rios coming to you live from National Harbor, Maryland. This is CPAC, and it's always fun to be here. About 10,000 people gathering here in this beautiful setting in Maryland to talk about all things conservative. And sitting in front of me is someone who's been in this movement for a long time, and I've never met him until today. I can't believe it. But his name is Chris Kobach. Chris is the former Secretary of State for Kansas. You may remember that he ran for governor this last race and won the primary and then was defeated by the Democrat in the general election. He also came to fame as Secretary of State because he started going after cleaning up the voter rolls. And probably, I'm guessing, we're going to get into this, probably not a fan of motor voter, I'm guessing. And, of course, after the election of Donald Trump, he was appointed to the President's Commission on Voting Rights, along with Christian Adams and Hans von Spakovsky and others. And Chris, I should let you tell people what happened to that commission from your own words, sir. How did that go down?
Well, thanks for having me, Sandy. It's great to be on your show. President Trump established the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. I served as the vice chairman along with President Pence, who was the chair, or Vice President Pence, who was the chair. And it was we were starting to dig in and get some very significant numbers on the incidence of voter fraud in multiple forms, whether it be double voting, non-citizens voting, other forms of voter crimes. And the ACLU and the aligned organizations on the left that do not want to do anything to secure our voter rolls, they immediately sued. And we ended up encountering a full 12 lawsuits. I think in the end it might have been up to 13 lawsuits across the country. And the decision was made. It literally hobbled us so that our staff was spending more time filling out interrogatories, doing depositions, and addressing the lawsuits than doing the work of the commission. And so a decision was made in the White House that they had succeeded. The left had succeeded in pulling us down through lawsuits. All of them frivolous. You know, one or two got a small concession like, okay, you have to open up these records or this or that. But it was really astounding because the left does not want the full extent of voter fraud brought public. And we pointed out many, many things already. The incidence of double voting is huge. There was one study in 21 states which found thousands upon thousands of cases of people voting in multiple states. In Kansas, I have had, as Secretary of State, I had prosecutorial authority. And we prosecuted approximately a dozen cases of voter fraud, of double voting in just 2 years. And, of course, non-citizens voting is a very big problem, especially in states like California and Texas. In Kansas, we've prosecuted such cases. We are in a battle, the state of Kansas is, against the ACLU on our proof of citizenship requirement. There are only four states, Sandy, believe it or not, only four states in America that require you to prove your citizenship when you register. Those are Kansas, Arizona, Georgia, and Alabama. In the other 46 states, you walk up, you fill out a card, you check the box that says I am 18, you check the box that says I'm a U.S. citizen, and you're good to go. No one is going to try to verify your citizenship. There will be no further inquiry. And that is why we have the commission was going to try to determine the total number, but we have a huge number of non-citizens on the voter rolls. Experts looked at the Kansas. We found 127 cases in Kansas where we were able to use external evidence to find people. But experts looking at it in the trial estimated the number could be in the multiple thousands, perhaps even over 30,000. State like California, I would say it's likely that you have at least 500,000, perhaps over 1 million non-citizens on the rolls. And when you're talking about close elections,
which we are almost every state, every election now.
If you have 500, 1,000, 2,000 non-citizens in the mix, those are usually enough to sway the race, to steal the race one way or the other.
Well, isn't it interesting? I'm sure you had the gag reflex that I had every time in the final years of President Obama's presidency. He would say, there's no voter fraud. That's a lie. There's no problem with voting and voter fraud in this country. That became a mantra. It was like,
yeah.
It
shows the pure, shallow political partisanship of the Democrats on this issue. Because in 2011, when I, as Secretary of State in Kansas, proposed that Kansas be the first state to have photo ID, proof of citizenship, and equivalent security for mail-in ballots, we would combine all three. We had bipartisan majorities in 2011. Then in 2012, the Democrat Party nationally said, "Oh, we're changing our position. We are officially against photo ID." And then they all switched, including people in my state. And now, with the North Carolina rerun of the election, they're all saying, "Oh yeah, voter fraud exists, so we acknowledge it." But I guarantee you, as soon as the North Carolina redo is done, they'll be back to saying that there is no such thing as voter fraud.
And we should also include in this conversation that if Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership are introducing, they may have already, I think it's called HB1. I think that's the name of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Horrible legislation.
That really will legalize voter fraud. That's how I've heard it described.
It will make voter fraud extremely easy to accomplish by forcing states to have things like same-day registration, automatic registration, where if you're on any government list, you automatically become registered to vote, which is a very bad idea because government lists are always corrupted by bad information. And so, anyway, And it would make it impossible for states like Kansas to have proof of citizenship. In order to do the proof of citizenship process, you have to have multiple days between the day of registration and the day of voting, unless you required people to bring their passport or their birth certificate with them to the polls, which would be too onerous. So, yeah, it's a bad bill that Pelosi's offering, and what a surprise.
You know, this reminds me of, forgive me for digressing for a second, but... you remember that communist regimes took over in Central and South America through coups and violent efforts. And then when Russia fell, led by Cuba, they started this new method. It came out of what was called the Sao Paulo Forum, where they decided if they could get their people elected during the democratic process, that would be much cleaner.
Yeah.
And then they would set about to rewrite the Constitution, take over the banks, take over the institutions, and that's what they did. And that's how they've taken power. That's how they took power in Venezuela and other countries. So this, to me, honestly, Chris, is the precursor to that. The left wants to take over in the ballot box, and then once they do, we can already see their lawlessness. It's not hard to figure this out.
Well, I make the point often when I talk about this issue, why would anybody object to requiring proof of citizenship when you vote?
Exactly.
Unless you believe that non-citizens should get a jump on the process and should not have to wait the 5 years or however many years it takes that particular individual to become a citizen. Let's just get them started voting right now. And that is happening in huge numbers in California. It's happening in significant numbers in Kansas and huge numbers in Texas. And this is a real problem of stealing the American elections and the American democratic process
and then doing
using
away,
non-citizens.
And then they will do away with the Constitution, I guarantee you. We already see that they have no respect for it.
True.
And so, Chris... a lot of the Democratic candidates for president embrace this non-citizen voting. A lot of them do.
Yeah, some say, let's just let them vote.
Yeah, it just doesn't matter. No borders. Yeah, everybody votes. And speaking of the 2020, you're thinking about running for Senate, aren't you?
I'm considering it. There is an open U.S. Senate seat in Kansas. That was the seat that is the seat currently held by U.S. Senator Pat Roberts. He's announced his retirement, so it will be open.
Yeah. So you're from Wichita, right?
Actually, grew up in Topeka.
Topeka. All right, you're a pretty controversial character since is Kansas, would we say it's
I take that as
now?
A compliment, right?
Well, I am one too, so everybody I know and love is, so I don't know.
No, Kansas is not purple, to answer your question, but there is a pattern that goes back 54 years. Kansas has never had a Republican succeed a Republican or a Democrat succeed a Democrat as governor. It goes back and forth, and there are interesting reasons behind that, which we can talk about if you want to. But anyway, yeah, it was, historically speaking, a Democrat was supposed to get elected governor in Kansas, and it happened. It is a bizarre pattern we have. That's why we inflicted Kathleen Sebelius on the rest of the country. She was a former governor of ours.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm from Illinois, Chicago, so we gave you a few.
You guys are solid blue.
Too, yeah. So, Chris, you are actually right now the general counsel for the We Build the Wall effort. We should talk about that. That's wounded veteran.
Yes, Brian Colfage started it. Many people may have heard about this. In December, he did a GoFundMe page that went viral, more than any other GoFundMe in the history of that entity. In about 20 days, he raised $20 million, and his claim or his argument to the people in GoFundMe was, hey, Congress isn't funding the wall, let's just chip in our own money.
I've heard lots of people say they want to do that.
Yeah.
Lots of people.
So over 300,000 Americans did. He raised $20 million, and then he realized, wait a minute, if I just write a check on behalf of these people for $20 million, the feds are going to take that money and do nothing with it. So he then said, let's convert it into a private organization, and we'll just go to private property owners and say, we build the wall is here to build on your property if you would like us to. We'll do it for free. And that's what we've done. We've converted it to a private organization. The people who donated to the GoFundMe were sent an email saying, if you'd like to convert your money to this private organization, you may. And so far, something like 94% have done that. And so we are, at this point, getting ready to break ground probably in April.
Wow.
And we are building the wall with private funds right on the border where private land is on the border. And just put this in perspective, Sandy. So, we have a 1,933-mile border. If you count only barriers that will stop pedestrians, see, sometimes Democrats and open borders people will say that, oh, this section is secure, and what they mean is they have a Normandy vehicle barrier. That's just a horizontal metal beam supported by some X posts. But that doesn't stop pedestrians. You hop right over. But if you count barriers that will stop pedestrians, we have fewer than 100 miles of that 900 miles is secure. President Trump got funding for 55 more miles. 55. And even if President Trump gets all of the $8 billion he seeks to reprogram through the national emergency and other statutes, he still will have a grand total of under 300 miles that he builds. But that leaves 1,400 miles wide open, which is why you need private efforts. This is an immense problem. I just came back from the border last week. We have to have the government building. We have to have private entities building. I believe state governments on the border should be building. This is a massive problem, and it's not something we can fix in like 1 year. We have got to get to working it focused on it. I think, you know, people have been hearing things like the Obama administration when they said, oh, the border's under control. We've got most barriers on. It's not true.
And
it's
a lot
wide
less
open.
People are coming across. There's nothing to see. No problem, right?
Yeah. But if people want to help, they can go to WeBuildTheWall.us.
Okay.
And it's a great entity, and we're actually doing it. And we're doing it for about... Well, at this point, we estimate it's going to be about a fifth of the cost of the federal government. Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Chris, I'm guessing that the bill, the funding bill, so-called funding bill, I was going to say a word I shouldn't say, that horrible funding bill that was just signed by the president, can't restrict private lands from having, can they?
Well,
I'm sure they would if they could.
They can, actually. It does say that, so basically the bill says that the president can build in the Rio Grande Valley sector, which is the sector, the farthest east sector of the Mexican border right up to the Gulf. And it says, however, there are about half a dozen places where no building is permitted. And those half a dozen places, it would be problematic if a private landowner tried to build there, too. But the rest of the border is wide open, and there are literally thousands of private property owners along the southern border. And so that's where we're going, to private property, where they are free. They have a property right to protect their cattle, to protect their persons, their physical safety. Ranchers have died on the border, like Robert Krentz in Arizona, famously. And so many private landowners are saying, please come to my land, build here. In one case, a rancher has had, believe it or not, cattle rustlers coming over from Mexico to steal his cattle. And he wants a wall.
Yeah, well, I've talked to all of those ranchers, and I can attest to that. It's like the Wild West for them. It's just been unsafe for a long time. But it affects the whole country. That's the part that people don't understand. Every state is a border state. There are problems for all of us, whether it's drugs or sex trafficking or...
Or higher taxes. We are all paying higher taxes because of the public benefits illegal aliens are consuming.
Crowded hospitals, crowded schools, because we're obligated to take care of them once they get here. We have a problem.
Yes.
Chris, you encourage me.
Well,
you remind me of my also rebel friends who just will not give up. So that didn't work, so now we're going to do this. So you're one
fighting.
Of those. All right, so Senate 2020, maybe. Chris Kobach from Kansas, Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.